The following is a CKUW 95.9 FM original program, celebrating 60 years on the U of W campus, created by volunteers in our community and made possible by generous listeners.
Hey, it's Lucy King here. Thanks so much for listening to Making Contact. If you want to support our work all year long, please consider signing up to make a monthly donation. Just $5 a month will help fund our social justice reporting all year long. Now, here's the show.
Our system is, in too many ways, broken.
The way we see the world shapes the way that we treat it.
This is Making Contact.
I'm Amy Gastelum. This is Making Contact. Last week, we brought you a story about one Hoosier family's journey to continue their 11-year-old daughter Kieran's gender-affirming medical care now that Indiana has banned it for minors. In that story, we talked a lot about what regular old community members like yourself can do to support gender-diverse youth despite increasing discriminatory laws. Today, we're bringing you the second in this two-part series about trans youth and their survival. You remember Dr. Myesha Price. She was featured in last week's story. She's an associate professor in the Human Development Program at Indiana University as part of the Counseling and Ed Psych Department. She's also an associate research scientist at the Kinsey Institute. And Dr. Price is also a parent to a gender-fluid child and holds an identity as both Black and queer herself. Dr. Price studies mental health of LGBTQ plus youth.
The area that I want to focus on now is what can we do about resilience in LGBTQ young people? While we can do something politically, like we can vote, we can support politicians who are going to pass legislation that's going to protect our young people, I don't know that that change is going to come tomorrow. And so my take on this is we have to do something to keep our young people alive today.
Dr. Price is the perfect person to ask about a data point that emerged from the Trevor Project's 2023 National Survey on the Mental Health of LGBTQ plus youth. But before we get to that specific data point, I need to give you some background. Okay, the Trevor Project is an organization that started 25 years ago to prevent suicide in LGBTQ plus youth. Their programs include a 24/7 crisis line, advocacy, research, peer support, education, and public awareness. The Mental Health Survey is an almost 30,000 strong convenience sample of LGBTQ plus youth. These kids found the survey online. That limits who it's going to represent. It's not as generalizable as population-based data like the CDC's Youth Risk Behavior Survey, or YRBS, but it helps us understand what might be happening in various subgroups of the umbrella LGBTQ plus youth population. Suicidality is a big problem for LGBTQ plus youth, especially trans and non-binary youth. The CDC's YRBS shows that 1 in 3 trans respondents attempted suicide in the year prior. 1 in 3. But the YRBS doesn't break down the demographics on trans youth in terms of other identities. So, like kids who are both trans and Native, for example, a very vulnerable group. The Trevor Project designed their survey to be able to sort of home in on various subgroups. And here's the data point I wanted to ask Dr. Price about. The survey showed that for respondents who are both Black and trans, having the support of their families of origin was a significant protective factor for suicidality. And I asked Dr. Price if she could make a guess about why family support is so important for this group.
Yeah, family support is particularly protective for Black, trans, and non-binary young people. And while I don't have all the answers for why it's important, I haven't been able to explore that in any specific detail. My sort of working theory about that is that within the Black community, family is valued, and having the support of your family is something that a lot of young people sort of hold as something that is invaluable to them. And so once that support is taken away, it's sort of like all of your support network is gone, right? And so there are so many things that are sort of passed down in terms of how you can Black resilience, if that makes sense, is sort of passed down when you think about all of the hardships that the Black community has experienced over the years, and more recent than I think people like to think it was, particularly compared to the triumphs that the Black community has seen, and the resilience that's there. That's something that's passed down over the generations, right? The things that are taught within the family in terms of how to overcome racism, what to expect, and, you know, how to navigate that, could easily be pulled in terms of that support for being trans and non-binary. And so when that happens, I think is when we see some of these better mental health outcomes, right? So that knowledge is easily transferable. And so when that happens, this, again, is my working theory, that we can see a lot of those same skills being used to support them in their various identities.
Growing up, Dr. Price says her parents were pretty young and they were busy keeping the family afloat. She says that might be why they sort of let her be her in many ways.
I look back on the clothes I was wearing, and now that I know about children's clothing, I know those were not girls' clothes, some of the clothes I was wearing. Not all of them. There's a nice little mixture going on, which is honestly who I am today. But my favorite outfit, I had to be somewhere between third and fifth grade. But it was a pair of pants that were blue, like royal blue pants, probably jeans, but and a T-shirt that had someone, baseball player, swinging a bat and a blue rectangle around. And I know that did not come out of the girls' section. And they let me wear that, you know, like my parents were like, fine, like they stopped picking my clothes out pretty early on. And so there wasn't a whole lot of restrictions on what we could wear, how we presented ourselves. And I'm grateful for that, that I could explore, you know, particularly in terms of how I wanted to dress, I would say.
Hello.
Good morning.
50 miles north of Bloomington in Indianapolis, Flo Michelle Battles is starting her work week with an interview with me. She leads the organization Trans Solutions Research and Resource Center as their interim executive director. Trans Solutions is led by and for Black and brown trans and non-binary people. It's run out of a former house on a busy east-west thoroughfare with a bus line. This place is a gathering spot, a hub. The living room is an open computer lab, and since they have a full bathroom, they allow members to use the shower. They offer education and mentorship to their clients, many of whom are pretty young. Ms. Battle says Trans Solutions is, first, simply a place for Black and brown trans and non-binary people to exist safely.
Because, you know, safety for a lot of folks in our community is knowing that you can go to a place and you won't be misgendered. You know, that's safety. That makes them feel secure. But even bigger than that, and it's something that I take very, very seriously, is that I hope that we're showing young trans women, young trans men, our non-binary siblings, that we can live normal lives. We can, you know, be out in the world moving around. And so I hope that we're showing them that, because the majority of our staff is, you know, trans or non-binary, BIPOC community. So we're just being examples. And sometimes, like, all people need, they just need to see it, you know, and know that it's real and it's tangible. That right there is making it a safe space.
Their main thing is connecting clients to other community resources, weekly HIV testing, gender marker and name change support, mental health services, that sort of thing. But this fall, they're launching a direct service called the Vision Program. Here's how it works. A client meets with one of Trans Solutions resource coordinators. They're sort of like a social worker. And together, they create an individual success plan. Essentially, it's a goal a client wants to meet within the next 6 months. It could be anything.
It may be, I want to get my high school diploma or my GED in 6 months, you know, or I really would like to have an office job, but I'm, you know, I'm not good with computers, or I'm not good with, you know, word processing or those type of things. And so maybe their goal is that in 6 months they want to be ready to apply for that office job. And hopefully it will get the clients in that thought process of, okay, this is how I set goals. These are the steps that I take to reach the goals.
Clients learn skills through computer modules that are developed by the Trans Solutions team and produced by a Black trans woman, Imani Sloan. So far, the themes include workforce development, housing, and health and wellness. Some of the modules, like financial literacy, will be mandatory, but the point is to be flexible and include topics clients really want and need. One life skills module Ms. Battles pitched the team was on how to take your own body measurements to make shopping for clothes easier.
And at first, you know, everybody was like, well, we want to really take the time to put this in the educational learning system. And I'm like, absolutely. Because for a lot of trans and non-binary folks, you know, it's uncomfortable going into the stores and trying things, having to go into the fitting room and try things on or have a person, you know, measuring you. You know, those are uncomfortable situations. And so we rely heavily on online shopping. Well, as you know, especially for, you know, the femme part of it, you know, a size 10 in this brand can fit like a size 4 in this brand. And so, you know, myself being an introvert, I am a huge online shopper. And so what I did is I learned to measure myself. So then I can just go look at measurements. Okay, so I need this size because it's closest to my measurements. And once I explained that, they was like, "Huh, makes a lot of sense."
The way you're describing, like, coming up with these modules, I'm imagining, like, a bunch of aunties sitting around this table and being like, what do our babies need?
No,
like, very maternal.
No, absolutely. And that is kind of how some of those beginning conversations were. You had myself, you had our founder and executive director, Marissa Miller. At the time, you know, we had a program manager that was working that is a trans woman. And then you have myself and Imani. So it was basically a table of aunties, like, okay, like, what do these babies need? What didn't we have? What are we trying to figure out now that we can give to them, you know, at 18, at 16 even, you know, so that they don't have to be in their 40s trying to figure it all out. So in essence, that kind of is exactly what it was.
Yeah. So beautiful. I love that.
This gathering of aunties is common practice in the LGBTQ plus community. Chosen family has always been an important way for LGBTQ plus people to create support systems. But Ms. Battles is welcoming to her clients' families of origin too. She says some parents of Trans Solutions clients want to know more about what it means to be gender diverse or trans. So they reach out, often via email.
And they're like, hey, this is what it is. Like, I don't know what else. And so, you know, we have months of conversations just, you know, hey, let me be a resource as much as I can. And it made me think back to something that my dad was really big on growing up. And it's that, you know, people can only do what they know how to do. So if they've never been shown or if they've never been taught a new way, then we can't expect that from them. And so for some of these parents, you know, depending, especially when you're talking about like the Black community, a lot of parents, you know, they have been in the church so deep from, you know, birth. And so they've never really encountered, there wasn't anything that they ever thought would happen to them, you know, but then, you know, here we are, and now you have, you know, a 17-year-old that is figuring out who they are. And, you know, you do have those parents that kind of need to be taught how to love their trans or non-binary child.
I asked Ms. Battles what she makes of the Trevor Project survey, showing that almost 60% of Black, trans, and non-binary youth respondents seriously considered suicide in the 12 months prior to the survey. 25% attempted. This is higher than some other groups in the survey.
And I'm wondering, like, do you have any ideas about why you think that's happening? Speculation is just fine.
Well, I will say this. You know, I can definitely see why that number would be much higher, you know, because it can be very rough, disproportionately, for Black and brown, trans, and non-binary folks. A lot of it starts at home. And a lot of it starts with our own family members. And so you leave home or you go out into society from home that because of your transness is telling you that you don't amount to anything or is giving, making sure your life is nothing but hurdles and struggles. Well, then you walk out into society and where in general, they may be a little more accepting of your transness, but now you have all these built-in hurdles because you're Black or because you're brown. And so, you know, stereotypes are thrown on you and, you know, doors are shut in your face, windows are slammed on your fingers. And so, like, where do you win? You know, I very much consider myself to be a privileged Black trans woman. And that privilege comes from, I've always had my family support. I've always been encouraged to be me and do me. So I feel like, again, I use the word privileged because I think I don't feel like I struggled as much as, you know, a lot of my siblings struggled because I had my safe space, which was my family. So no matter what, if I did go out into society and somebody said something negative or, you know, I was treated a certain way, I had a safe space to go back to. So, you know, it definitely makes a difference.
You're listening to Making Contact. Just jumping in here to remind you to visit us online if you like today's show or want to leave us a comment. We have more information at radioproject.org. And now, back to the show.
I'm Amy Gastelum. Welcome back to Making Contact. These days, children and teens are coming out as gender diverse or lesbian or gay at younger ages than ever before. Because they're coming out earlier, kids' gender identity and sexual orientation is more politicized than ever. These young people are facing adult hate and discrimination. So despite progress in LGBTQ+ rights, LGBTQ+ kids are increasingly vulnerable. But Dr. Caitlin Ryan of San Francisco State University says support from families of origin, like the support Dr. Price and Ms. Battles had as kids, is incredibly protective for LGBTQ+ youth. She's made it her life's work to help all families, especially socially conservative families, learn to support their LGBTQ+ kids. And back in 2002, Dr. Ryan, along with Dr. Rafael Diaz, conducted the first comprehensive study of LGBTQ+ youth and their families.
And we identified over 100 different behaviors that parents and caregivers use to respond to their LGBTQ children. And then we measured all of those behaviors and we could show how the rejecting behaviors contributed to serious health risks.
Risks like suicidal ideation and attempts, higher levels of clinical depression, substance use disorders, and behaviors that increase their risk for infection with HIV.
And also, there was significant levels of conflict in the family. They were more likely to be removed from the home and placed in foster care or end up in juvenile justice or end up unhoused.
Rejecting behaviors include things like
preventing the child from attending family events and gatherings because who they are shamed the families, or when they were walking down the street together as a family, that the family would physically separate from that queer identified child, sending a message to people on the street, you don't belong to us. So there were so many of these behaviors that were so hurtful and painful that they not only separated the child, but they contributed to estrangement and to diminished sense of self-esteem and self-worth. And it foreshortened a sense of hope for the future. And the accepting behaviors helped protect against risk, strengthen the family, and promote well-being for that LGBTQ young person.
Doctors Ryan and Diaz learned that one of the most impactful protective behaviors a parent can do for an LGBTQ+ child is to simply listen to them.
even when they're struggling, and believe that being gay or transgender is wrong, just sitting and talking with your child, simply listening to them without interrupting or punishing them or ridiculing them, hearing what it's like for them, and making it a safe space to talk about their experiences. That's a simple behavior that everybody can do, and that is a behavior that our research shows helps protect against risk and promote well-being.
Dr. Ryan and Dr. Diaz took what they learned about these rejecting and protective behaviors and developed an evidence-informed family support model to help socially conservative families learn to support their LGBTQ+ kids. The model is applied directly with families in therapy, and it's also taught as a training for people who interact with young people and their parents, mental health providers, teachers, community workers, clinicians, clergy, and on and on. This is a harm reduction model. That means it's not all or nothing. Think needle exchanges for people who use intravenous drugs, or Narcan distribution to prevent deaths from opioid overdose. Even condom distribution is harm reduction. The point is to stop rejecting behaviors, not to change how the parent feels or thinks about their child's queer identity. Once the parent in the program understands that their rejecting behaviors can lead to major problems for their kids, it motivates them to change what they're doing, not necessarily how they're thinking or feeling. But Dr. Ryan says, even lowering some rejecting behaviors can have a significant positive impact on a kid.
You don't have to accept an identity that you believe is wrong to stand up for your child. And when you do, it sends a powerful message to that child that I love you, I care for you, I'm going to be there for you. Even though I'm struggling, I'm not going to reject you. And the great fear, I think, that LGBTQ young people have is that not only their families will reject them, but that they'll be separated from their culture, from their faith traditions, from things that are very deeply meaningful for them. We have worked with families across cultural groups, across ethnic and racial backgrounds, faith traditions, and we found that all families really want the same thing. They want their children to be happy and healthy.
Parents who have learned from the family support model often go on to become liaisons for other socially conservative parents. Dr. Ryan says the program has had a big impact within the Mormon faith, for example.
One of the powerful things that I've seen time and again is that as many parents learn the risk their child face in society at large, they then see that so many other young LGBTQ people don't have anybody to stand up for them. And many of them become advocates for other people's LGBTQ children. And in fact, I've worked with many diverse families that looked like they were super conservative on the surface, but ended up becoming community leaders in developing services for LGBTQ young people and their families from their cultural and faith backgrounds.
Because they had been through it themselves, that learning curve.
That learning curve, and also a realization that we are all part of a community, and that it really takes everybody taking responsibility for those children who are abandoned and alone and suffering.
Dr. Ryan is deeply concerned about the increased politicization of children's identities we've seen in recent years.
We're never going to have healthy communities when we have adults attacking children's identities and, you know, muddying and disturbing any sense of peace that parents would have with having an LGBTQ child. The kinds of misinformation and, you know, carefully projected disinformation today is horrific. And when we begin to think about the impact of misinformation and disinformation and lies, most of which is generated out of hate and as a way to raise money for really very distorted systems, we can only counteract that with the truth. And we're, I need to stop this or it will just continue to beep.
Dr. Ryan is busy with trainings across the nation and even overseas.
Well, that's good.
In this moment, Dr. Ryan is responding to a text from a Lakota Tribal Nation member.
It's just a Lakota translation of our Family Acceptance Project name. Hang on a second.
The community has asked her to come provide a training, and that'll happen in the next few months. The Family Acceptance Project can't be everywhere at once, so the team created a website with culturally diverse resources for families and a national resource map. Check this episode's show notes at radioproject.org for more information. The project also created a free downloadable poster series that lists the protective behaviors that families and community members can engage to support LGBTQ plus youth. The posters are free to use. Go get them. And Dr. Ryan says they're designed to be hung anywhere.
In clinic waiting rooms, in counseling offices, in various spaces in schools, in locker rooms, in public housing, in child welfare offices.
The posters come in 10 languages.
We're trying to disseminate these posters in as many places as possible because they can do something really, really, really important and simple. They can start the dialogue that families should be and are a critical part of the lives of their LGBTQ children.
Okay, so we've covered clinical guidance for how to build healthy communities for LGBTQ plus youth, but Dr. Maisha Price is walking both sides of that line, a researcher and non-binary parent to a gender-fluid child. So I wanted to ask her something that isn't really captured in the data when it comes to protective factors and just leading an embodied life as a Black trans person. What is the role of joy?
Oh, gosh. Joy is, in my opinion, joy is an act of resistance. I think it is experiencing something that in many ways is vital to your continued existence despite everything contrary to that. When I see it in its pure form and not something that feels forced, it's a beautiful thing. Like, it's just amazing that, like, particularly in groups where you're like, wow, you get to just let down all of your guards and just experience this pure form of happiness. And I think that is, again, purely an act of resistance against any harm that is wished upon these young people in particular.
So not so much the Instagram post, but I'm wondering if, like, if there's something that comes to mind when you talk about that, if there was like an instance that you're like, oh yeah, I'm thinking of this.
I was just talking to a friend of mine and we were talking about sometimes how hard it is to be a parent. And I was like, yes, her kid is about to be two. And I was like, just wait though, like, you get to play. And I think it's kind of this interesting thing that, like, sometimes play is work with your kid, I will admit. But sometimes it's not. Sometimes you get to do things that spark that childhood joy in you. And it's so amazing because even if it's for like 10 minutes, all of the, like, I have to do dishes, I have work to do, is gone. And you're just playing. Like, you're just kicking a ball, or you're just building Lego sets, or whatever the case is. You're just playing. Like, you're just running around pretending to be a dinosaur. And that to me is an experience of joy. Or you're just out, you know, looking at water, or you're just out rolling down a hill with grass or something. And it's just, ultimately, you have forgotten the burden of the world around you, and you're just experiencing something for what it is, and that's happiness. And I think that, to me, is what I think about when I think about joy.
I'm Amy Gastelum. You've been listening to Making Contact. All of the resources mentioned in this episode are listed in the episode's show notes. Go to our website, radioproject.org, or follow us on social media to learn more. Happy Pride Month to everybody. Until next week.
You're listening to CKUW 95.9 FM, Winnipeg.
Hey, it's Lucy King here. Thanks so much for listening to Making Contact. If you want to support our work all year long, please consider signing up to make a monthly donation. Just $5 a month will help fund our social justice reporting all year long. Now, here's the show.
Our system is, in too many ways, broken.
The The way we see the world shapes the way that we treat it.
This is Making Contact.
Clausens are a middle-class family in a small college town, Bloomington, Indiana. Their neighborhood streets wind through soft hills dotted with two-story houses. When we arrived, the family greeted me and my co-producer Emily at the door with smiles. Beth, the matriarch, has kind eyes and short gray hair. Her husband, Nathaniel, was wearing a shirt that said, "Gender-affirming care saves lives." The Clausens' three kids were there, too. Izzy is home from college. Max lives at home while he attends Indiana University. And the youngest is 11-year-old Kieran.
I'm Amy.
Beth.
I'm Nathaniel.
I'm guessing. This is Emily.
I came to see them because I wanted to talk about an Indiana law banning medical gender-affirming care for minors. The Clausens, along with the ACLU, some other families, and a family practice doctor, sued Indiana over the law when it was passed. The Clausens' daughter, Kieran, was receiving gender-affirming care, and they were worried about what the law would mean for her. And they were angry. They weren't the only ones. In this clip from one of the bill's hearings, you can faintly hear protesters chanting under State Rep Bradford Barrett's opening remarks.
I would ask people in here to please remain seated, to please limit. I'd like for no signs, banners, or flags. I would like people to please stay seated, and then outbursts of any kind will not be tolerated.
The lawsuit the Clausens brought resulted in an injunction, meaning the law was stopped from going into effect. So at the time of this interview, Kieran was still seeing her healthcare providers in Indiana. But the Clausens knew a ruling could come any day that would force them to seek care out of state. When the bill was first brought, Nathaniel particularly was ready to take action. He knew he was in a privileged position in many ways and felt obligated to take a stand. For one thing, the company he works for supports his advocacy for trans youth. He says in Indiana, that's rare.
I get to speak out, and it's considered one of our caring values. And we really felt like we had to speak up to protect the other families with trans kids that we know about.
The Clausens never expected to be activists or to sue a whole state. Beth admits she really likes when everyone just gets along, and she isn't a fan of change generally. But she and Nathaniel are also devoted parents. Max and Izzy, the older kids, are both cisgender. They're only 18 months apart. And when Izzy and Max were school-aged, Beth and Nathaniel added Kieran to the mix. Max and Izzy said when Kieran was a toddler, she was adorable and loved to be the center of attention. And they were happy to give it. Nathaniel showed me a video of Kieran on his phone. She was 2 years old, wearing a dress-up skirt and dancing. You can hear Izzy laughing in the background.
Hey, Kieran, can you do the hula hula?
Featuring one of the dresses she had stolen from me.
Oh, really? That was yours, the skirt?
It was a dress-up skirt when I was a kid, and then it had been in my room, and as soon as Kieran was old enough to walk, she was like, oh my God, it's pink, and it has a flower on it. And then she stole it.
At two, Kieran dressing in skirts for fun was not an issue for Beth. She thought it was a phase. It was cute and funny. But whether trans, non-binary, or cisgender, many kids have some internal sense of their gender by the time they're 3 years old. And when she was just learning to walk, Kieran often wrapped a towel around her head as if it were long hair and then admired her reflection in the oven door. When she was a little older, Kieran raided Izzy's dress-up clothes and wore them around the house. Eventually, if she wasn't wearing a dress-up outfit, she refused to leave the house. When Beth would try to put boy clothes on Kieran, she would go stiff and not move. A silent but complete boycott. Beth remembers texting her friend, who has a son only 2 years older than Kieran.
When do they get out of this temper tantrum age when they don't want to put their clothes on? And she was like, that never happened with her youngest son. And then I thought about it. I was like, that never really happened with my older two either. Like, this is definitely a new thing.
The conflict sometimes kept them from going out. I asked Beth what that was like for her.
It was a little scary because we started noticing things were a little different. And then she started not being her happy self. She started, you know, withdrawing, and as the tantrums, not tantrums, I hate saying that word because it sounds like she was just being petulant, and that's not what it was. The distress of wearing clothing that she didn't feel describe her. And if you're asking me how it made me feel, it made me feel scared. Not because, I am going to cry. It made me feel scared because I didn't want anything to be hard for her. And I kind of was gathering that things would be scary for me and her and hard. And so I was scared. And I think I felt bad for being scared. I remember specifically I was like, it's not that Kieran wants to wear girl clothes. It's that she just wants to be dressed up. So I started buying button down shirts and corduroy pants, so Kieran would look, for lack of a better word, handsome. And then I had a friend say, sorry. I had a friend say Kieran didn't seem like Kieran, like herself, because it was just a day where I put my foot down and I said, we're just going to wear these boy clothes. And they just talked about how Kieran, even at 2.5, or I don't even know how old she was not 3, just like all of the light was out of her. And I was like, oh my gosh, you're right. And then that's when I decided that I can't be scared, and we can't be scared. We just had to do the thing that made my kid be the happy kid that she was, when it all I had to do was let her wear a dress.
Izzy shifted in her seat and raised her hand.
I think that my parents aren't giving themselves enough credit with the amount of research and time they spent looking into it. Because it wasn't them just going, oh, we're going to stick you in these clothes. It was, we can't find a reason for this. It's new and we don't know what it is.
The watershed moment where we realized that we had to do something was Kieran got out of the bathtub and was running around the house and grabbed a pair of scissors and said, can I cut my penis off? I don't like it very much. And I mean, comically, I don't think any boy has ever wanted to cut their penis off. And so we realized right then that she wasn't a boy. And it was at that point that we let her transition
socially.
And what did that look like? What did that mean for you?
So we went to a local shoe store and we bought her some Elsa and Anna shoes, and they were silver and blue. And she was so excited, she slept in them.
After that, they let Kieran shop in the girls' section at stores.
Seeing her smile and seeing her excitement was so powerful because, as Beth said, she had started to get a little depressed. And we said, okay, if she changes her mind later in life, she'll at least know we love her and listen to her.
You're listening to Making Contact. Just jumping in here to remind you to visit us online if you like today's show or want to leave us a comment. We have more information at radioproject.org. And now, back to the show.
Hey there, welcome back to the show. I'm Amy Gastelum. You're listening to Making Contact. After Beth and Nathaniel Claussen started to support their trans feminine daughter Kieran's social transition, they informed their friends and family first. They told me everybody was pretty accepting and willing to learn. But helping Kieran come out as trans was a process. And pretty soon after they bought the Frozen shoes, Kieran got sick, so Beth took her to a clinic to get checked out. She stumbled over Kieran's pronouns during the visit, and the nurse noticed.
And she called me afterwards and just was like, I noticed that you were struggling with how to talk about Kieran. And she's like, would you and Kieran like to talk with someone about Kieran's gender? And so I said, absolutely. I didn't know where in Blooming to find that. And it's always meant a lot to me. And I still see her at the grocery store. I don't ever say, remember that time? But yeah, she took the time out of her her own personal time to find my number and call me and reach out with the therapist who she knew would be understanding and affirming. And so we made an appointment with that therapist, and we've seen that therapist off and on ever since.
Kieran's healthcare providers in Bloomington eventually referred her to Riley Children's Hospital in Indianapolis and their gender health program. There, Kieran received wraparound, multidisciplinary, collaborative care from pediatricians, psychologists, and social workers. This is in line with best practice, according to health experts. And while having a supportive mental health and medical team is important, affirmation from other adults in the lives of gender diverse kids is crucial. I asked Kieran what school's been like for her.
School has been great because my school is very acceptive. My preschool was also pretty acceptive, and so was the school that I went to before I transferred.
When it was time for Kieran to start kindergarten, Beth wanted to inform some people at the school that Kieran was trans and would be attending as a girl.
We met with the school social worker. We met with the principal. The social worker had had experience with trans students in the past, so she knew what it meant to, you know, affirm and accept Kieran to school.
The social worker worked with the teachers. She made sure that people understood it was okay for Kieran to share her information if she wanted to. It wasn't a secret, but it was for Kieran and the Claussens to share, not anyone else.
So really, we were set up from the beginning for success.
The American Academy of Pediatrics says the decision of whether and when to start gender affirmative treatment is personal and must consider that each patient and family is unique. They say caring for transgender youth ideally happens on an ongoing basis with the entire care team. There is no prescribed path, sequence, or endpoint to this care, but they recognize the positive impact of affirming treatment and care on gender diverse kids who suffer disproportionately from drug use problems, STIs, and suicidal ideation and attempts. According to the latest data on transgender youth from the CDC's Youth Risk Behavior Survey, just over 1 in 3 trans respondents attempted suicide in the year prior.
Knock, knock. Hi. Hello.
How are you? I'm good. Just up the road from the Claussens, Dr. Maisha Price is studying LGBTQ plus youth, specifically resilience. When I met them at their office at Indiana University, they were just settling in after moving here from California. The office was completely bare.
I literally brought supplies here today.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah,
I feel like I'm accosting you, like before you can even get like
settled. It's fine. It's good.
Dr. Price is an associate professor in the Human Development Program at IU as part of the Counseling and Ed Psych Department. And she's also an associate research scientist at the Kinsey Institute.
I share this because it informs the work that I do, but I am Black, queer, and I'm also a solo parent to a 5-year-old who was assigned male at birth, but enjoys wearing skirts, tutus, and has specifically asked me for a Barbie dream house with a slide, to be exact. And is currently navigating which bathroom to use at school. So that's exciting.
Dr. Price confirms LGBTQ plus youth experience poor mental health and suicidality disproportionately. And she's careful to point out the reason why.
So I think a lot of people get a little bit mixed up because they feel as though, well, it's because your queer identity that you're suffering. And ultimately, there's a middle person in there, and that's the way that they're treated. So one of the things we know and that we see over and over again is that it's the discrimination, the stigma, the bullying, the physical harm, the rejection that they're getting that is then causing these poor mental health outcomes that they see. It's internalizing also the negative things that are happening in society. And so now you feel as though you're a bad person because of the identity that you have.
Dr. Price says the impact of bans on gender-affirming medical care, like Indiana's new law, have a sort of underbelly.
The ban itself isn't really impacting that many young people. And I think people would be surprised to hear me say that. But I think there's this assumption that there's like millions of trans young people who are flocking to medical facilities to get gender-affirming care. And I want to back up and talk about what it even is.
Dr. Price says all gender-diverse kids benefit from the social aspects of affirming their gender. Things like using preferred pronouns, chosen names, and affirming their use of the bathroom that aligns with their gender. But everybody's different. She says many gender-diverse youth aren't seeking treatment like puberty blockers or hormone replacement in order to affirm their identities. And they might never choose to do that. But the legislation banning care is still harmful to them.
So what we're doing effectively is sending a message to millions of young people, even those who are not ever even interested in getting this care, that they are not worthy of being affirmed. Like, we're essentially saying what we're going to do is pass a law that says your value in our society is lesser than other people's. And so that's one of the conversations we're not having about this is the mental health impact of not only the passing of these bills, but the debate, the very debate of them that's happening.
Beth and Nathaniel decided not to allow Kieran to speak during the law's hearings. The hearings were contentious and they wanted to protect her. I asked Kieran if she'd like to share what she would have said if given the chance. And she did.
I may be a small child, but if you make me mad, I'll make sure your eardrums burst with my screams.
On top of experiencing the discrimination of anti-trans laws, some gender-diverse adolescents suffer when they get closer to puberty that doesn't align with their gender identity. Some kids experience increased isolation and depression. They may have problems with their relationships or academics. In Kieran's case, Beth, Nathaniel, and Kieran's entire care team noticed she was having problems the closer she got to puberty. Kieran's doctor has checked her quarterly for the physical and hormonal changes of puberty. Once puberty starts, an endocrinologist can prescribe puberty blockers, which simply stop it until the kid is ready to think about how to proceed with their development. Depending on the person and the care team, a teen may then eventually receive hormones that match the puberty of their gender identity, estrogen for trans feminine teens and testosterone for trans masculine teens. The hormones are the same that are used for cisgender kids who are experiencing early or precocious puberty. Children and adolescents have used these medications since the 1980s. The hormones are reversible, though there is some data to show that prolonged use poses an increased risk for bone loss in trans feminine kids who receive them. In April 2023, Kieran's doctor placed a puberty-blocking hormone implant in her arm. It's a slow-release device, sort of like a contraceptive implant. It stopped her testosterone-rich puberty so that she would have time to consider receiving estrogen later on.
It didn't hurt, but the numbing shot did hurt. And I turned my mom's hand blue.
Squeezing it.
Yeah.
Kieran says she hasn't loved the visits to her doctor because of the puberty checks.
But it's mandatory, and it's making sure that I don't want to go ka-splat off a building. So, yay.
What do you mean when you say you don't want to go ka-splat off a building?
No comment.
Okay, because I think that what you're talking about is suicide. Is that right? Okay.
Yeah, I didn't want to say the word because it is a sensitive topic for some people.
It is. You're right. And we're going to be really careful about the way that we talk about it.
The mental health fallout of Kieran not receiving care has worried Nathaniel. His brother died by suicide in 2022.
Puberty sucks for everybody, but to go through a puberty that doesn't align with who you know yourself to be, I don't want my kid taking her life because she has to go through a testosterone-rich puberty.
At the time of this interview, the Claussens were waiting to find out whether Indiana's ban on gender-affirming treatment would go into effect, forcing them to travel out of state for Kieran's care. They were on edge. But here's the thing. What happens to trans kids in conservative states does not rest solely with legislators. Dr. Price says there are things that everyone in every community can do to support them. Things like what Beth's friend did in pointing out Kieran's distress, or what Kieran's nurse practitioner did, what Kieran's school administrators and teachers did. Even Nathaniel's employer supporting his advocacy work is empowering.
What does the literature tell us about proven prevention or protective measures for suicidality among LGBTQ youth? I mean, that's a big question.
Broadly speaking, the protective measures are supportive people, supportive environments. I would say, generally speaking, that's letting people, young people, be who they want to be. And I know that we can do that. We can do that when it comes to music. Well, most of us can do that. When it comes to music, sports, like, we can do that. We can. We can do that when it comes to gender identity and sexual orientation. Like, I promise we can. So let's just bring all that in, right? Like, teachers, coaches, all these people that young people spend time around, if they're affirming and supportive, like, it can literally save lives.
Having safe, supportive schools is a moral imperative.
It is illegal to not be at school. So if we're going to force them to be there, we have to make it safe for them to be there. That's just baseline. So what does affirming schools look like? And again, there's a lot of different ways, but we can think about gender neutral bathrooms. We can talk about making sure that young people have the option of using their chosen name, pronouns, and things like that are so important. Specifically addressing sexual orientation and gender identity in your bullying policies and being strict about them, not just saying it and moving on. Training staff, all these things are so important when we're talking about how to create a safe environment for young people.
And this includes family functions.
If you're thinking about holidays, you're thinking about things like that, like, would you take your child or the young person in your life to a situation where someone's going to hit them in the head with a bat? No, you would not expose them to something physically harmful, so you shouldn't do it if it's going to be mentally harmful.
A few months after our first visit, I called the Claussens via video chat. Nathaniel and Beth sat down in front of the camera while Kieran danced in a gold skirt in the background. Kieran, you look amazing today. I really like that top.
Thanks.
It's really cute. You look very cute. Back in February, Nathaniel was driving home from work one evening, and he was just passing the Kroger in Bloomington when a lawyer from the ACLU called him.
I pulled over, and they were shaken up, and in listening to them, it shook me up a little bit as well.
The hammer had fallen. The injunction was stayed. The ban was immediately in effect. The law didn't disrupt Kieran's medical care as much as some other kids, because her puberty-blocking hormones were administered by an implant. But many adolescents get puberty-blocking hormones as shots.
So, you know, like, families went to bed and they woke up in the morning and their prescriptions couldn't be filled. Or they had doctor's appointments the next day and the doctor's offices had to call and say, you can't come in. Or if you come in, we can't discuss gender-affirming care because this law went in place.
And you know this because you were talking with other families?
Yes. Like,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. The Claussens have decided to go to Boston for Kieran's care. It's not the closest place to get care. Chicago is. But they chose Boston in part because they thought the clinics there might not be as crowded as Chicago, a place that's now a hub for folks from surrounding states with bans.
The law bans gender-affirming care for minors, but it also states that physicians cannot refer their clients out to other providers. So, like, how are people getting this information and resources outside of from their care providers, their physicians? Do you know?
Yes. A lot of it is word of mouth. parents reaching out to other parents. There's organizations like Gender Nexus, Protect Our People, Gecko. Another group would be Trans Solutions. They're located in Indianapolis.
Okay. For more information about the organizations connecting people to care and a national resource map, go to our website, radioproject.org, where you can find links in the show notes. Beth and Nathaniel have continued their advocacy work. They say it helps them feel less powerless to help others. The organization Beth helped start, Protect Our People, has been connecting Hoosiers to gender-affirming care outside the state.
We actually were able to help two people this past week get the care that they needed.
She says donations to Protect Our People have increased too.
But I would say the greater population doesn't have any idea what's going on still. Families with trans kids and the trans community in general are kind of are living an alternative reality. You know, Kieran still asks us questions like, wait a minute, I can still get my diabetes care, right? Like we have to remind her or reassure her that it's just this one kind of care.
Kieran, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Would you feel comfortable sharing like how you're feeling right now?
About what?
Just with the changes, now that everything's gone into that the ban has gone into effect in February, like, how do you feel about that?
Oh, I don't really care. I'm used to this. I'm used to being hated on.
That sounds hard. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I think she doesn't want to talk about it. She doesn't want to hear about it. Like, she's done.
Yeah, that's totally fair. Now the Clausens are turning toward each other and toward Joy. I asked them, besides this law, what's new?
We spontaneously got a new puppy a couple of weeks ago. It was the most impulsive puppy adoption ever.
Impulsive puppy adoption.
And it was totally worth it.
I asked Beth how our listeners could get involved.
Talking to their legislators. They don't have to understand what it means to be transgender or to have a transgender child, but they need to talk to their legislators about how wrong it is for them to be making decisions for people's children. There's doctors for that reason. They are not doctors.
She says another thing anyone can do is support organizations that help trans kids and also speaking up.
And telling people that we are all on the same side. We all love our kids and we all want what's best for them. If we could just get that message across.
Great. Is there anything else you think I should know?
Kieran would like to show you the puppy, if that's okay.
Oh my gosh. Yes. Show me the puppy. Oh, she's huge. Oh my gosh.
She's not very cuddly right now.
Yeah, but we named her Socks.
What?
Because her front two paws.
I get it. Very cute. I'm Amy Gastelum. Thanks for listening to Making Contact. Next week, we will continue the conversation with Dr. Maisha Price and get into one factor that may help Black, trans, and non-binary youth, particularly from suicidality. If you or someone you know needs confidential support with suicide prevention, call the free 24/7 national hotline 988. Until next week.
From the heart of downtown Winnipeg, you're listening to CKUW 95.9 FM campus-based community radio.
This is David Barsamian, host and director of Alternative Radio. Alternative Radio can be heard on CKUW 95.9 FM every Wednesday at 1 p.m. Alternative Radio is committed to the principles of public broadcasting, offering a forum for voices and views often unheard in mainstream media. Like CKUW, Alternative Radio is supported by listeners just like you. Go to alternativeradio.org to find out more about our programming, audio, and transcripts. Thank you very much.
Dave Barber Cinematheque, from cult classics to documentaries, from experimental surrealism to captivating realism, you can find a seat and some popcorn at 100 Arthur Street. Check out their show listings, updated monthly, at DaveBarberCinematheque.com. Show your CKUW Friends card and get member pricing for any regular screening.